I think perhaps I should say something really very serious, very, very, very serious about all of this this business. And, or then I think, well, no, maybe I shouldn't be serious. I shouldn't say serious things about how dangerous Halloween is. Maybe I should be bright and positive and give them lots of Christian leaflets to read about the Christian faith. Or maybe I think I should be horrible and pour a bucket of water over them. And then when I open the door, it's not a bunch of teenagers, but a three-year-old. Have you seen? Younger and younger, the trick-and-treaters. And their mum is standing at the edge of the drive. And I suddenly think, no, I'd better try and find a chocolate or something. Anyway. But it is serious. It is actually an issue that matters. There is a devil. He's real. The Bible says so, and if we're sensible, we'll see the evidence in our world today as well. We're not concentrating on him tonight, but we are thinking about not just the devil, but what we have to say about Jesus and his part in the devil's downfall. So we're going to read, first of all, from the Bible, Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4, verse 1. And that's page 967. Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the desert that be tempted by the devil. I'm sorry, I can't actually... Derek, please would you read this text to the passage for me? Because I've got my usual... can't read the... I can't get the... goodness me. Can you read that for me and then I'll try again?
That long word too, wasn't it? You're concerned. Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. After fasting for 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." Jesus answered, "It is written, 'Man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God.'" Then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. "If you are the Son of God," he said, "throw yourself down. For it is written, 'He will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands, so that you will not strike your foot against a stone.'" Jesus answered him, "It is also written, 'Do not put the Lord your God to the test.'" Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. "All this I will give you," he said, "if you will bow down and worship me." Jesus said to him, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, 'Worship the Lord your God and serve him only.'" Then the devil left him, and angels came and attended him.
Shall I keep going to the end of Revelation?
Keep it open and I'll come and summon you. There we are. Leading hand, Christopher Cramber, recently has made Royal Navy history. He is a member of the crew of Her Majesty's frigate, the Cumberland. And he recently persuaded his captain to officially recognise his religion. Christopher Cramber is the first ever Satanist to be registered in that way. And he's now campaigning the Ministry of Defence to recognise devil worship as an official religion in the armed forces. And what do you think about that? Some people would say that it's really just a matter of human rights. So long as Christopher Cramber does his job on board ship properly and doesn't interfere with anyone else who's not interested, then we should let him get on with it. We've got no right to question whether his beliefs are right or wrong. Others would be perhaps just a little bit more worried than that. All right, so you might say, so the devil himself isn't real and to believe in him is silly and superstitious and doesn't do any harm. But Satanists believe that the devil is good and good is evil. And would you want to work with someone who sincerely believes that it's good to lie and cheat and steal? Would you want to entrust £100 million worth of Royal Navy warship and military hardware to somebody who believes that sin is a good thing? That's not very wise, really, is it? And others would say that it's a very real danger, because the devil is real, and there is such a thing as spiritual evil. That's what the Bible says, anyway. Is it just silly superstition? Well, if you think about it, the Bible is not actually a silly, superstitious book full of nonsense. It doesn't really have a lot to say about ghosts, or hauntings, or witches, or magic, and most of the other things that people associate with Halloween. It doesn't really say a lot about those things. The Bible isn't full of fairy tale animals, or flying carpets, or talking creatures. The Bible isn't interested in silly superstitions. But it does tell us about the seriously supernatural. The Bible says there is a spiritual dimension to the universe, and it's a dimension that we know very little about. But as we were reading last night, it seems that in ages gone by, some of the beings that God made in that spiritual dimension rebelled against him and became evil. And then, of course, gave Adam and Eve, the first people, the idea. There are an unknown number of them, according to the Bible. Some of them are kept imprisoned and unable to do anything much, but there are others which are able to go out and about and get up to mischief. There are the evil spirits that Jesus himself dealt with. But chief among them is the one that we call the devil. Other names for him in the Bible are Satan, which means accuser, or Beelzebub, the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the great serpent or dragon, the enemy, the tempter, and lots of others besides. And it's not a joke. The cartoon picture gets painted of a devil with hooves, and tail, and a goatee beard, and bad breath. He's really had bad breath, doesn't he, the devil? And we laugh at the medieval cartoon. But the actual fact of the matter is that we live in a world where terrible evil is going on, evil that's real and organised and deliberate and serious. But of course, you don't have to dress up in funny clothes and an animal head to encounter the devil and his forces. Because as far as he's concerned, Halloween and all of that is really just a bit of a sideline. The devil spends far more of his time and effort in the ordinary, everyday world. And in fact, you have certainly met him, or at least encountered his influence, and without a goat's head in sight. Yes, he can exercise spiritual power and all kinds of other things. But his main attack on the human race is this. This is his main strategy. Persuade us to believe a lie. Persuade us to believe something that isn't true. Then tempt us to do something that is wrong, that separates us from God, so that then he can accuse us and condemn us and say to God, you've got to find them guilty because look what they have done. That's the basic way that the devil works. And it's that what I wish, which I want to concentrate on tonight. C.S. Lewis painted a picture of that when he described the white witch in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. The boy Edmund betrays his brothers, doesn't he? And later on in the book, they go to negotiate with her about his release. And the White Witch says, you know that every traitor belongs to me as my lawful prey, and that for every treachery I have a right to kill. That human creature is mine. His life is forfeit to me. His blood is my property. And that's a picture of how the devil tries to accuse us, and actually does accuse us, and how people belong to his kingdom because they're separated from God by their sins. First time round, it worked when he met Adam and Eve. Second time round, the devil met his match. Jesus met him face to face when he was alone and afraid and hungry and thirsty. Maybe in the pitch black of night and cold in the desert, or perhaps in the blazing heat and thirst of the desert sun. And the devil offered Jesus these three temptations. He laid three traps. And he still lays these traps today. So I'd like us to see what they are and how Jesus answered them. The first trap is to ignore or to bypass God. To ignore or bypass God. Verse 2, after fasting for 40 days and 40 nights, Jesus was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." Now, Jesus may have been the Son of God, but he was human like me and you. And being hungry and thirsty felt just the same as him as it does to us. And what the devil suggests seemed quite reasonable, didn't it? After all, the 40 days were up. Nearly, anyway. And if Jesus can turn water into wine at a party, or multiply loaves and fishes at a picnic, well, why shouldn't he turn stone into bread for himself after 40 long days in the desert? Not even cake, after all, just bread. But Jesus sees through it. The devil tempted him to use his power for himself rather than obey God. Jesus knew that he was hungry in the desert because God wanted him to be hungry in the desert. God had told him to be there. It was a test. And Jesus would eat when God said it was time to eat, not when old Goatface told him to. So he answered, "It's written, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God." Now, what's the equivalent for us? Most of us are never hungry for more than 40 minutes, let alone 40 days. And turning stones into bread is not an option, at least for most of us. Yet we all face a similar temptation one way or another. The temptation is stuff. Stuff. Things. Materialism. The devil tries to persuade us that there are things we need and must get that are more important to listening and obeying God. Spend your life getting stuff, he says. Forget about him. And most of the time, we don't really need too much persuading. Because we live in a culture and a society that's incredibly materialistic, don't we? And we assume that we can and we should have whatever we want whenever we want it. And if we don't have the things that we're supposed to have, then we think something awful must have gone somewhere. I haven't got a plasma television. How can I ever be happy again? And so we spend great chunks of our lives getting stuff. And then even more chunks of our lives keeping the stuff in the first place or replacing it when it's broken. Because, well, you can't really be without it once you've got it, can you? And if you've got a problem, well, the answer is to get more, better stuff, isn't it? And it's not supernatural at all. And it's not spooky at all. But it works like magic. It really does. So as far as the devil is concerned, the occult and all that is a useful sideline. But he really doesn't care whether people worship him or not. And he spends far more time in the shopping centre than he does at witches' covens. It's just as useful to him when people don't believe in him at all. What he really wants to do is to stop us obeying and putting our faith in God. That's what matters. And so long as he can keep us away from spiritual reality, doesn't matter how, then we belong to his kingdom already. And that's why the modern Western materialistic world is so spiritually dead. What's the alternative? Jesus shows us that however much you need something, you don't need that something more than you need God. However much you need something, whatever it is, you don't need it more than you need God. Even if you've been 40 days without food in the desert, you need God and the things he has to say to you more than you need bread or cake or plasma televisions or mobile phones that take pictures or holidays in the Maldives or whatever else it might be. Temptation one, ignore or bypass God onto the way to the stuff that you think you need. Temptation two is to test God. Verse 5. The devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. If you are the Son of God, he said, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift up their hands, so that you will not strike your foot against a stone. Now the temple was a very high building anyway, and the highest point of the temple was built on the very edge of a cliff. So if you stood on the top, you'd look down right into the deepest ravine in Jerusalem. And anyone jumping off would expect to make a very impressive mess on the rocks below. But not you, said the devil to Jesus. Doesn't the Bible say that God will send his angels to catch you? The devil's very good at this, you see, because he knows the Bible inside out. I'm sure he could preach very good sermons if he wanted to. And he happily twists it and quotes it to mean what it never meant. And he knows the best lies are those which are 95% true. So he says, prove you're the Son of God, a reasonable request. Test him out. Take him at his word. Jump. He will catch you. Now I wonder, has anybody here ever been bungee jumping? Any bungee jumpers here? Any? No hands going up? No bungee jumpers? Anything similar? Parachutists? Or anything else? No? Oh, I see a parachutist there. Well, let me... why do you think people do bungee jumps? Any ideas? Any thoughts? Sorry? Hooked on adrenaline. Adrenaline rush. Is that what you were going to say, Jay? What do you think? Adrenaline rush. Are you ever tempted? And you wonder... whoever first got the idea of tying a piece of elastic around his leg and jumping off a bridge? My encyclopedia says that it originated somewhere in Australia, which is part of the reason, I'm sure. But I actually remember seeing once a TV documentary, and I'm sure this must have been where it started. Certain tribes in Papua New Guinea were jumping off platforms they built in the trees, except... they weren't using elastic. No, they were just using ropes. Ropes that weren't even stretchy. So they'd jump off and jerk to a halt with a twang that nearly pulled their legs off. It was a kind of initiation test. Something they did to prove their courage and their manhood. Well, basically, the devil tempted Jesus to go bungee jumping, didn't he? He challenged him to jump and prove something by what he did. And what's the modern form of this temptation? Well, maybe Norman's put his finger on it. Maybe he knows about it himself. Maybe it's when the devil tempts us to live for kicks, to take risks, to see how far we can push it. What the heck? Go for it. It'll be all right. What does it matter anyway? That thought underlies a lot of binge drinking and drug taking, casual relationships where people sleep together, why not? Petty crime. We know we shouldn't really do it, but hey, lots of other people do it, don't they? And they're all right, aren't they? People go bungee jumping like this to prove something to themselves or to their friends. They do it because it's fun and they get a buzz. Sometimes they'll do it to forget something else. And whether they know it or not, they're going bungee jumping with the devil and putting God to the test. This is one reason why some people do get tangled up in the occult, because it seems exciting. And lots of people today really are very, very bored with life. And this is very strange, isn't it? Because there's loads more to do nowadays than there ever used to be. But people are bored because God is that bit further away in their experience. And it's God who actually gives us enjoyment, not actually the things we do. But the occult has this air of mystery and excitement. It's the chance to be and do something a bit out of the ordinary that other people don't do. Discover some hidden secrets. Cross a few boundaries. Satanism is never going to apply to lots of people. It's rather hard to get a girlfriend if you're a Satanist, for a start. But far more likely to catch people out these days are the things that seem innocuous and harmless. Things like white witchcraft, using the same forces for nice things. Wicca, modern paganism, or tarot cards, or astrology, or dream reading, or astral projection, or all of these things. There's a list as long as your arm. Magazines with great vast lists of all the different things you can try out. Some of them spill over into some kinds of alternative medicines, or radical environmentalism. And every town now has at least one shop that sells magic books and trinkets. And nearly all of them are called Spellbound. They haven't got much originality. They always call this shop Spellbound. It seems like the better we understand our world scientifically and control it technologically, the more interested people seem to become in the weird and wonderful pseudo-spiritualities. And the important thing is, of course, the vast majority of these things are not promoted as bad or evil at all. They're put forward as good and beneficial. And most of the people involved in them are nice people who don't mean any harm and sincerely think what they're doing is for good. But the Bible warns us that the devil often comes as an angel of light. He dresses up nice. He knows that most people don't like to be thought of as evil. Most people like to think that they're doing good. So that's how he presents his propaganda. The Bible forbids us to have anything to do with that. Just leave it alone. Have nothing to do with any of it. People who play with these things are in danger of getting out of their depths into what they don't understand and are doing something that God's forbidden. So here's another way we can recognize the devil. He says, go on, give it a try. It'll be all right. God will sort you out in the end. And Jesus' answer is simple. Do not put the Lord your God to the test, he says. He is very patient, but God's patience doesn't last forever. The bungee gets thinner and thinner and stretchier every time. And one day, when we expect to jump and bounce, we will actually jump and snap and splat. Temptation one, ignore God. Spend yourself on stuff and forget about him. Temptation two, test God. Push the boundaries. Live on the edge. Jump and see if he catches you. Temptation three, play God. Verse 8. Again the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I will give you, he said, if you will bow down and worship me. So now he takes the gloves off. No more pussyfooting around, pretending to be good or reasonable or curious. A straight offer. Worship me, he said to Jesus, and I will give you all of this. He's offering Jesus a shortcut to power. And with none of the hard work along the way. No need to wander around Galilee getting blisters anymore, Jesus. No need to hang around with those smelly peasants anymore. No need to grovel and obey God. No need for a cross at the end of it. Just give us a kiss. And you get the lot now. if and when people do get heavily into the occult, it's often why? Because it offers power and status, the chance to be a bit significant and different. I'm looking for a few special people, is what snatches people in. Not that the devil actually does give anything to the poor individuals who do get sucked in. Christopher Cranmer is to be pitied and prayed for. May God rescue him from the prison that he's in and other people like him. But it's very interesting to notice what Jesus says. Because he doesn't say, get lost, Satan, you can't give me the whole world, does he? He doesn't say that, because up to a point, the devil could have given him it to. According to the Bible, the devil, in a sense, rules the world, at least for now. The saddest thing about HMS Cumberland is not that one sailor deliberately serves the devil, but that most of the others do without even knowing it. That's the sad thing. But then, of course, that's the case for the whole world without God. All over the planet are people who think they can play God and do things better than the way he has got in mind for us to do them. We think we can run our relationships better than God says. He says, wait till you get married. But we think we know better than that. We think we can manage our world better than God says. We think that we can live our lives better than God says. And that's what sin is all about. Sin is when we grab hold of the steering wheel of our lives and drive our own way, take our own shortcuts to what we want. It's not always when we do something outwardly evil or obviously wrong. It's simply that we're the ones deciding what we do. We're playing God. We're taking the shortcut. So I hope we can now recognize at least some of the ways in which the devil does try and trap us and keep us from God. I don't suppose very many of us will ever be that tempted to become Satanists. But most of us at some point will encounter spiritual practices which might look all right and even quite interesting and good on the surface, but underneath are his tricks, and he's luring you into something that you shouldn't get into. And all of us, day after day, we'll hear his temptations in other ways. Ignore God. Test God. Play God. Whatever you do, don't love God. Don't serve God. Don't obey God. And what should we do when we realize who it is who's trying to pull our strings? Jesus said to him, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, 'Worship the Lord your God and serve him only.'" Then the devil left him. And the angels came and attended him. Or as another verse puts it, resist the devil and he will flee from you. Because although he has got real power now, the devil's days are numbered. His time is up. When the devil met Jesus, he met his match. For every lie and temptation the devil told him in the desert, Jesus had the answer. And on the cross, when the devil put all his power and energy into destroying Jesus Christ, he suffered the worst that the devil could throw at him, and then he rose from the dead. He took it full on, and then he lived to prove that he had won the fight. And he shows us that if we put our faith in him and follow him, there is a kingdom we can belong to that is greater and stronger than the devil's kingdom. And if you're in with Christ, there is not a thing the devil can do to hurt you in the end. But how can it work? How can the death and resurrection of Jesus set us free from the power of the devil that otherwise grips us? Well, remember the story from C.S. Lewis, from The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, that I talked about earlier. They go to the White Witch and they try to negotiate for Edmund to be set free. And he is. And then that night, Lucy and Susan discover an awful, terrible truth. In order for Edmund, the traitor, to be set free, Aslan has offered himself to die in his place. Aslan, the king, the lion, has offered himself. And they watch with horror as he is tied up to the great stone table. His mane is shaved off. The ogres and the hags and the goblins spit at him and whip him. And then the white witch takes a knife and prepares for the execution and bends down and whispers in Aslan's ear for the last time, "And now, who has won? Fool, did you think that by all this you would save the human traitor? Now I will kill you instead of him, as our pact was, and so the deep magic will be appeased. But when you are dead, what will prevent me from killing him as well? And who will take him out of my hand then? Understand that you have given me Narnia forever. You have lost your own life, and you have not saved his. In that knowledge, despair and die, Aslan." And the knife falls. And the girls spend the night in despair and horror. And in the morning, they go for one last look at the body of Aslan. Then they stand for a moment looking out towards the sea as the red turns to gold along the line of the seashore. And at that moment, they hear from behind them a loud noise, a great cracking, deafening noise, as if a giant had broken his plate. They run back to the stone table and they find it split in two pieces by a great crack, and there is no Aslan. Then suddenly the sound of a familiar voice behind them. There, shining in the sunrise, larger than they had seen him before, shaking his mane, which had grown again, stood Aslan himself. And he explains, "Though the witch knew the deep magic, there is a magic deeper still, which she did not know. Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time. But if she could have looked a little further back, into the stillness and darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backwards." And this is how the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ rescues us from the devil. The willing victim who has committed no treachery dies in our place, then lives again. Death works backwards, and the devil has nothing to say. So make sure, when you think about the devil, that the death works backwards for you.